Pacifica Network. This is Democracy Now!
Jalal Talabani, an Iraqi Kurd, is president of Iraq in a country where 85% of the people are ethnic Arabs. How will the rest of the Arab world take this new face of Iraq, and not only the Arab world, but also Turkey?
Abdel Mahdi is the current finance minister of Iraq, and he is the man who has single-handedly, most aggressively implemented the Bush administration's economic agenda in Iraq. He is definitely someone who the administration is very happy to have on the new political team leading Iraq.
Zalmay Khalilzad's nomination as ambassador to Iraq shows that the U.S. remains bent on reshaping Iraq in its imperial interests, not Iraqi interests, as part of a global strategy of greater, more dominant empire.
As a new U.S. ambassador prepares to take over in Iraq, Kurdish leader Jalal Talabani is named president, and his deputies have strong ties to the U.S. One was the former U.S.-installed president, the other a pro-U.S. politician who recently proposed privatizing Iraq's oil. Today, a roundtable discussion on the Iraqi government, some analysts say, looks more like a U.S. government. And pressure mounts on House Majority Leader Tom DeLay to resign after several more scandals come to light. We'll speak with Texas journalist Lou DeBose, author of The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Party. All that and more coming up. Slower. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, Kurdish leader Jalal Talabani is being sworn in today as Iraq's new president. Talabani told reporters his presidency shows that, quote, all Iraqis are equal before the law. He said, quote, it means there's no discrimination, that all Arabs, Kurds, and other nationalities have the same rights. Also being sworn in today are Talabani's two deputies, the Sunni Ghazi Yawar, who had been serving as the interim president, and Shiite Adil Abdul Mahdi, who is the country's former finance minister. The U.S. military has been accused of taking two Iraqi women hostage in order to pressure their wanted relatives to surrender. This, according to a report by the Reuters news agency. The U.S. has confirmed the two women are in custody, but have not revealed why they're being held. The Al-Batawi family is claiming U.S. soldiers and officers in the Iraqi National Guard came to the house in Taji looking for three brothers in the family. But since the men weren't there, the troops seized their mother and sister. The family showed a Reuters reporter a note left by the troops that read in Arabic, quote, be a man and give yourself up, and then we will release your sisters. Otherwise, they'll spend a long time in detention. Amnesty International says the U.S. might have broken international law by taking the women. The U.S. Justice Department has admitted for the first time the FBI used a secret search warrant to enter the home of Brandon Mayfield, the lawyer from Portland, Oregon, while it was investigating the March 2004 train bombings in Madrid. With the search warrant, FBI agents secretly entered the house of Mayfield, where they took over 300 photographs and seized material, including DNA samples and fingerprints. Based in part on that search, the FBI mistakenly linked Mayfield, who is a convert to Islam, to the bombings. He was then arrested and jailed. The FBI claimed his fingerprints matched a set of fingerprints on a bag of detonators connected to the bombing in Madrid. Mayfield was freed after 2 weeks when the FBI realized they made a mistake matching the fingerprints. The Washington Post is reporting the investigation has essentially ended into who within the Bush administration leaked the identity of covert CIA operative Valerie Plame. Legal experts and sources close to the case speculated Wednesday that Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald is not likely to seek any criminal indictments. On March 22nd, Fitzgerald filed legal papers that suggested the investigation is over, except for interviews with two reporters who've refused to testify. Fitzgerald's filing was part of his effort to persuade the court to order the testimony of New York Times reporter Judith Miller and Time magazine reporter Matt Cooper to wrap up his investigation. Miller and Cooper potentially face prison sentences for refusing to testify. The office of Republican Senator Mel Martinez of Florida has admitted it was behind the controversial memo that said it would be in the political interest of the Republican Party to intervene in the Terri Schiavo case. One line in the memo reads, quote, "This is an important moral issue, and the pro-life base will be excited that the Senate is debating this important issue." For weeks, right-wing pundits have suggested the memo was a fake. Martinez's legal counsel, Brian Darling, took credit for drafting the memo. He resigned on Wednesday. A newly declassified report by the National Academy of Sciences has found the government has failed to address the risk of hijacked planes flying into nuclear power plants. The report states, quote, "There are currently no requirements in place to defend against the kinds of larger-scale, premeditated, skillful attacks that were carried out on September 11, 2001. The National Academy is considered to be the country's premier scientific body. The report was completed months ago, but the NRC had been attempting to keep the entire report classified. The report also states that federal secrecy edicts designed to keep information from would-be attackers were paradoxically hurting efforts to defend against such attacks. White supremacist Matthew Hale was sentenced Wednesday to 40 years in prison for plotting to assassinate a federal judge. Hale's the leader of a white power group called Creativity. The group was called the World Church of the Creator. But a federal judge ruled Hale had to change the group's name for trademark reasons. Hale then tried to arrange for that judge, Joan Humphrey Lefkow, to be killed. Lefkow's the same judge who was in the news in February when her husband and mother were murdered in her home. At the time, Hale was seen as a top suspect, but police ended up arresting a man unconnected to the White Power movement. That man, Bart Ross, confessed to killing the judge's family. He since committed suicide. A historic bus ride is taking place today in Kashmir. For the first time in 60 years, bus service has resumed between the Pakistan-controlled part of Kashmir to the Indian-controlled part of the region. Pakistani militants opposed to the Indian rule have vowed to disrupt the buses. On Wednesday, in Srinagar, the capital of Indian Kashmir, four militant groups set fire to a highly fortified compound where passengers were waiting to board the bus. The passengers were evacuated safely, but a gun battle broke out between police and the militants. The BBC reports two militants were shot dead, three bystanders were hurt, and earlier today the bus came under a grenade attack, but no one was injured. The news service is being seen as a symbol of improving relations between India and Pakistan, both of whom claim Kashmir in its entirety. The bus service is intended to enable Kashmiris to visit their kin living on opposite sides of the line of control that divides the disputed territory. In Afghanistan, 16 U.S. troops died after their transport plane crashed on Wednesday. It marks the deadliest incident for the U.S. military in 3.5 years of combat in Afghanistan. And on Capitol Hill, Democratic senators have temporarily blocked the confirmation of President Bush's nominees to head the Environmental Protection Agency and the Food and Drug Administration. EPA nominee Stephen Johnson came under intense criticism by Senator Barbara Boxer for his role in a controversial pesticide testing experiment in Florida. Under that program, federal researchers offered low-income parents in Duval County nearly $1,000 to allow scientists to measure the effects of pesticides on children under the age of 1 year. Boxer called the program unethical and immoral. She said, quote, "It's environmental injustice where children are the victims." Hearings were also held Wednesday for Lester Crawford, who's been nominated to head the FDA. Democratic Senators Hillary Clinton of New York and Patty Murray of Washington vowed to hold up his nomination until the FDA allows the morning-after pill be sold. Last year, an expert panel of scientists recommended the emergency contraceptive known as Plan B be sold, but the FDA has yet to issue a final ruling. Makam Hataimi by Farida here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Kurdish leader Jalal Talabani is due to be sworn in today as Iraq's new president. The National Assembly ended 2 months of deadlock Wednesday when it elected Talabani to the largely ceremonial post. He becomes the first non-Arab president of an Arab country. Talabani told reporters his presidency, quote, means there's no discrimination, that all Arabs, Kurds, and other nationalities have the same rights. Ousted leader Saddam Hussein reportedly watched the ceremony from his prison cell on a TV set up by his jailers. The Iraqi government also named outgoing finance minister Adel Abdelmahdi as outgoing interim president Ghazi Yawar as the country's two vice presidents. The three men will serve together on the presidency council. They're expected to name Shiite politician Ibrahim Jafri to the powerful post of prime minister. Cabinet ministers are expected to be named by next week. The transitional government's main task will be to oversee the drafting of a permanent Iraqi constitution and pave the way for elections in December. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice announced that Zameh Khalilzad has officially been nominated to replace John Negroponte as ambassador to Iraq. Khalilzad has been serving as the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. He was a leading backer of overthrowing Saddam Hussein and has close ties to neoconservatives in Washington. In 1998, he co-signed a letter to President Clinton sent by the Project for the New American Century calling for regime change in Iraq. Today, we take an in-depth look at the new government in Iraq. We are joined on the line from London by veteran Middle East journalist Dilla Piro. His trilogy of books on Iraq and Iran are considered some of the most definitive histories of the wars in the Persian Gulf. His latest book is called Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom and After. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Dilla Piro.
Yeah, good morning to you.
It's good to have you join us. Can you talk about the new government of Iraq?
Yes, certainly. I can give you a very quick biographical sketch of Jalal Talabani. He was born in 1934. In a place in Kurdistan called Khoi Sanjak, and he trained as a lawyer. He went to Baghdad University, joined the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which was then run by Mustafa Barzani, a tribal Islamic leader, and then fell out with him, with Barzani Sr., and actually went over to work with the government in Baghdad. And then, after quite a few twists and turns, in 1975, he briefly joined the Kurdistan Democratic Party, then left to go and live in Beirut. And when he was in Beirut in the mid-70s, he came under the influence of George Habash, the leader of the Palestine Liberation Front, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, who was a Marxist leader. And he then in 76 set up, along with others, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, the PUK, which actually described itself as a Marxist-Leninist organization. And that is the organization of which he has been a leader. And he has changed sides so often that I think it would be very boring for me to go through with each twist and turn. There's a very long entry on him in my book, The Essential Middle East, A Comprehensive Guide. Finally, I noticed that he's being described as a guerrilla leader who fought Saddam Hussein. I can tell you, Amy, that after this 1991 Gulf War, when there was uprising of Kurds, which was suppressed by Saddam's regime, he then later on went to head a Kurdish delegation. And in June 1991, actually, they made a deal with Saddam Hussein. And I have a picture of him, Jalal Talabani, kissing the cheeks of Saddam Hussein, and that picture appears in my book, Desert Shield to Desert Storm. Anybody can check it out. So he's being described as a guerrilla leader. Basically, he is, to put it simply, an opportunist. And, of course, he has his support in Kurdistan. And again, we talk of Kurdistan. Two things to remember. One is that the formation of what is called Kurdistan Autonomous Region, KAR, happened in 1974 under the regime of Saddam Hussein. And these three provinces in the north, which are Kurdish majority, they are basically divided into two parts. The southeastern part is under the control of the PUK, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, of which he, Talabani, is the leader, which is next door to Iran, and therefore General Talabani had a very long tradition of good relations with Iran, though of course he wouldn't want to talk about them now. And it's a northwestern part of Kurdistan where the Barzanis, who is the son of the senior Barzani, by the way, the senior Barzani actually died in hospital in Virginia. He was very close to the Americans in the 1970s. So we have the situation where basically these two Kurdish parties, the KDP, the Kurdistan Democratic Party, and the PUK, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, came together and formed a Kurdistan Alliance and contested these elections on the January 30th, and they won 75 seats out of 275. Now, the Kurds are no more than 15 to 16% of the population. They are entitled to maybe about 40 seats. They won 75. The 25 seats they have won have come at the expense of the Sunni Arabs. So, by the way, all I can say that Sunni Arabs are definitely not happy. In fact, they're very upset at what's happened, that he has become president. That's not the only point. The other thing is that you have to remember Turkey is next door. And Turkey is, by the way, of course, we have to remind ourselves, the member of NATO, is very close to America. And they have their Kurdish population, which is 20% of the national population. They are next door to the Iraqi Kurdistan. They are very unhappy at this rising influence and power of Iraqi Kurds, who now want to make the regional capital of Kirkuk, which is an oil-rich city, which will give them a very powerful economic base and prepare them for declaring independence of Kurdistan. So it's something which is going to have, you know, severe repercussions as time goes by.
Will the northern Iraqi Kurds fight as hard for independence if Jalal Talabani is the Kurdish president of Iraq?
Well, I think it's not that they will go for it now. You see, basically, if, of course, we are told it's a ceremonial job. Yes, in practice it is. But you see, also, of course, he has two deputy vice presidents. One of them is Sunni and the other is a Shiite. And they must always take joint, unanimous decisions. So unanimously, they have to decide who to choose as a potential prime minister, who is actually the executive prime minister. And so no decision can be taken unless all three of them agree. That's one. Secondly, as you rightly pointed out in your introduction, the main task, the one of the main tasks of this government will be to have a permanent constitution. And from the way things have gone so far, the Kurds are going to press very hard to get maximum autonomy. And that is not going to go down very well with the rest of the, you know, Iraqi population, especially the Shiites. The Shiites are mostly, you know, what you call very religious. According to them, in Islam, there's no ethnic difference. At the same time, the Kurds will insist on having more power. Next thing to remember is that since 1991, because of the Anglo-American air umbrella of Kurdistan, the Kurdistan has been functioning basically as a semi-independent country. They have their own educational system. They have their own police. They have their own militia, which is now turned into an army, which is not a part of the central command in Baghdad. They have refused to allow other units of the Iraqi army to enter Kurdistan. And so all of this actually is a preparation for at some point to declare independent Kurdistan. That is the fear of Turkey.
Dilapiro, what about Jalal Talabani's relationship with the CIA?
Well, of course, I have to say not only his relationship with the CIA, but also his relationship with the intelligence agency of Iran. You know, this is one of the amazing things. If you really go into this this whole intelligence world, you'll be dumbstruck to find these overlappings and so on and so forth.
Sounds a little like Ahmed Chalabi.
Absolutely. Except that Chalabi was never actually, you know, living, never lived in Iraq, and when his parents left when he was only 12 or 13. And unlike them, of course, Talabani as well as Barzani, they have been living not what you may call proper Iraq, but in the Iraqi Kurdistan. And so in that sense, they have, you know, more ground support, a proper constituency. At the same time, given this kind of location they have. As I said, you have to look at the map to see the southeastern Kurdistan is next to Iran. There's no way you can operate, run this part of the world without having some good relationship with Iran. And the other thing to remember, of course, all these guys now, of course, claim secularism and they have so much against Iranian mullahs. But remember, in the 1980 to 88 Iran-Iraq war, the Kurdistan, the Kurdish militia, run both by Talabani and Barzani, fought alongside the Iranians and against the Iraqi soldiers. So in a way, you could say that they committed, in quote, a treason to be fighting, you know, their own national army while working with the enemy. So I think that they have such a long and checkered and opportunistic background to therefore always point out he was a guerrilla leader. I mean, I find very hard to take in. And of course, the relationship with the intelligence agencies is all over the place. And of course, the one man who really comes out on top in that business, who is right now technically the prime minister of Iraq, is Ayaz Alawi. He publicly said, I have received money from 12 intelligence agencies. I think he should go down in the Guinness Book of Records.
We are talking to De La Pirro. His latest book is Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom and After. We'll break. We'll come back to De La Pirro and other guests to talk about the new Iraqi government. Stay with us. Corporation here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast on over 330 stations around the country on public access TV and Pacifica radio stations and affiliates, NPR stations and PBS stations, as well as on both satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV 9410, Link TV, and DirecTV's Channel 375 Link TV. We also video and audio stream at democracynow.org, and our closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing, and you can bring us to your community on radio or television. Just go to our website, democracynet.org, and find out how. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the new Iraqi government, we're joined by analyst De La Pirro from Britain. We are also joined now by activist and author Antonia Juhas. For years, she was project director at the International Forum on Globalization, currently working on a book about corporate globalization and Iraq. We're also joined by author Larry Everest, who's the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Antonia Juhas, let's go to you. You write about the former Iraqi finance minister, now one of the deputy presidents, Abdul Mahdi. Can you talk about him?
Sure, and thanks for having me this morning. Basically, Abdul Mahdi is an economist and a politician who currently serves as the finance minister of Iraq and also served on the Iraqi Governing Council. He was the leader of the United Iraqi Alliance ticket, the Shiite party, pegged to be the prime minister of Iraq. Then through the negotiations that happened after January 30th, he, as you said, has become one of the vice presidents and part of the presidency council. He can be considered the Bush administration's economic man on the ground in Iraq. After Paul Bremer, who was the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, the U.S. government of occupied Iraq, left, Abdel-Mahdi essentially took over to implement the economic transformations that Paul Bremer had set into place in his 100 Bremer orders, which fundamentally restructured the Iraqi economy. Mahdi essentially implemented those ideas and moved them forward. He has taken two trips to D.C. He took two trips prior to the January 30th elections, one in October and one in December. Both times he met, or at least one of the two visits, with both President Bush and Vice President Cheney. And he announced in a press conference while in D.C. negotiations on a new oil law for Iraq that he said would be very good for U.S. oil companies that would look at privatization of the oil. And he also talked about all of the economic reforms that he put into place to fundamentally shift Iraq from a state-controlled economy to an economy completely open to foreign investment, free trade, and the like. He wasn't elected president and won't be prime minister. However, remaining in a leadership, a key leadership post, makes it very likely at a minimum that he'll continue to work, try to work to push all of those economic reforms. And just to also be clear, he is in the position to keep doing that for one simple reason, which is that the Bremer orders, those economic changes, stay in effect unless they are specifically overturned by the new National Assembly, meaning they continue on unless they're specifically overturned. And Mahdi will be in a position to see those move forward. He is definitely somebody who is very much supported by the Bush administration and has continually expressed his commitment to U.S. corporations.
We're talking to Antonia Yuhas, author and activist. You write in your latest piece of oil and elections, remember when we used to talk about how the war in Iraq was about oil? Remember the banners that read, "No blood for oil"? Oil has fallen out of the discussion, but it's time to bring it back in light of the Iraqi elections. This was a little while ago, but you specifically, even then, before Abdel-Mahdi was known by most people, talk about this meeting he had in December of 2004. Can you describe it?
Yeah, this meeting, well, this was a press conference, and it was part of a couple of days' meetings of the U.S.-Iraq Economic Commission, which has met twice. That was the second time. Basically, a U.S. government, corporate Iraqi government body that came together for the second meeting to discuss, it seems, largely oil. The proceedings, of course, are not public. I've only seen press releases that the State Department put out. And the entire focus was on Iraq's economy and its transformation of oil. So at this press conference, Mahdi described what he was thinking about in terms of oil. And again, this is prior to the election, so it's definitely setting himself up as the person who the Americans should feel comfortable with. And at that meeting, he said that Iraq's oil law was being completely reconsidered. And of course, Iraq's oil was fully nationalized in 1972. It has been off limits to U.S. companies. The only company that has continued to do well is Chevron Texaco, which has been marketing Iraqi oil, selling it, both during the oil for food period and also currently has a contract to market Iraqi oil. The rest of the oil of Iraq has been completely shut off to U.S. companies, and obviously they've been very eager to get back in. And Mahdi discussed several changes, one of which would be privatization, full privatization of the oil sector, But the other is, you know, a slow process of opening up of the sector, either at a contract-by-contract basis or things like simply allowing foreign companies to come in and build oil infrastructure, pump oil out of the ground, do joint excavation policies with the Iraqi government. There's a whole slew of ways that the U.S. government or that the U.S. corporations can enter the Iraqi oil sector without full privatization needing to go forward. But he said full privatization. And again, he said, you know, basically this would be very good for U.S. companies. And the reason why he said that was because it is French and Russian companies that had contracts that were pending with Iraq, waiting for the sanctions to end. And basically most members of the current Iraqi government have said, we are not going to honor those contracts. And so Mahdi was saying, the French and Russian contracts are out. The door is open to U.S. companies. You know, I'm going to open it as far as it can go. Let's move forward these elections and get me into office, is how I read that process. And it has already been going forward. Chevron, Texaco, ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, they're all already offering free services in Iraq, training Iraqi oil workers, helping rewrite laws to open their access, bidding on oil fields in Kirkuk and elsewhere across Iraq, and they're poised and ready to go.
Antonia Yuhas with us from California. Larry Everest as well, author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Larry, you have been writing about Zalmay Khalilzad. Can you talk about the new U.S. ambassador to Iraq, formerly of Afghanistan?
Hi, Amy. Yeah, Zalmay Khalilzad has been a key player in both the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq. And even more importantly, and in some ways interestingly, of the global strategy that's really shaped those wars and U.S. actions since September 11th, the global strategy of radically restructuring relations in service of greater U.S. dominance around the world. And I feel his nomination as ambassador to Iraq really tells us two things. First, that the U.S., despite the resistance, despite the upheaval, the U.S. remains bent on reshaping Iraq to serve its interests, not Iraqi interests. And this is some of what Antonio was just referring to. And also that creating this pro-U.S. regime, a pro-U.S. neo-colony, really, in Iraq remains central to broader U.S. objectives in the region and in the world, including restructuring the Middle East, opening it up to greater U.S. investment, gaining greater control over world energy supplies, and let's not forget militarily dominating potential rivals like Russia and China. And it's really fascinating to look at his career because it opens a window onto the development of this whole grand strategy that's become enshrined as the Bush Doctrine. Khalilzad was born in Afghanistan, emigrated to the United States, and first began working in the government in 1984, the State Department, under Paul Wolfowitz. He moved over to defense under Dick Cheney and again Wolfowitz under the George H.W. Bush administration in 1988. And in 1992, he was the author of the first articulation of the strategy now in effect that the United States should prevent the rise of any rival powers. This was the so-called defense planning guidance. And this was a paper that also paid particular attention to making sure that the U.S. controlled the Persian Gulf and its oil supplies there. So we can see the genesis of the 2003 invasion over a decade earlier, when he and the other neoconservatives in the Bush government were out of office when Clinton took over. They spent the decades of the 90s elaborating this vision of U.S. global hegemony. Yemeni vociferously demanding more aggressive action around the world, as well as in Iraq, and including the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, as you mentioned in your run-up. And one of the interesting things, he wrote a book in 1995 titled From Containment to Global Leadership, and this was really a brief for U.S. global power to be extended all around the world. And very interesting, because he noted that in the wake of the Soviet Union's collapse, the United States faced both opportunities and also potential dangers, including the rise of new rivals, the shifting of world economic strength toward Asia, and so on. And he called for decisive action to lock in U.S. domination and argued this was an opportunity that the United States may never see again. And the other thing that's interesting about the book is it makes clear that the Bush strategy is not simply directed against the states like Iran and Iraq and North Korea, but it's also ultimately directed against other world powers, including Europe, Russia, and China. So this is really key to understanding the unfolding events, not just the two wars and occupations that we've seen, but also the growing tensions with Russia and China, Europe's unhappiness with the 2003 war, and so on. I should also add that in the 1990s, Khalilzad was a consultant to Unocal, one of the oil giants, at a time when Unocal was negotiating with the then Taliban government for rights to construct a pipeline across that country. And of course, when George W. Bush took over in 2000, Khalilzad became quite prominent as a National Security Council member. He was a special assistant for Near East, Southwest Asian, and North African affairs. He was involved in planning the occupation and reshaping of Iraq well before the war. Right before that war, he became the emissary to the Iraqi exiles that the U.S. hoped would eventually rule in Iraq. Plans haven't turned out as they thought they would. He oversaw the first meeting of those exiles in April 2003 in Iraq. Later that year, he was named ambassador to Afghanistan, where again he presided over U.S. efforts to try to solidify control over this very strategically located country. If you take the Middle East, where Iraq lies, and Central Asia, where Afghanistan lies, that's home to 80% of the world's energy supplies, and of course, a militarily strategic area. And we're just learning, the Financial Times just reported yesterday, that it seems very likely that the U.S. will be constructing a long-term military base in Afghanistan, and we know that they've been considering similar bases in Iraq. So Khalilzad has been at the very center of the efforts to both to dominate and control the future of the Afghani and the Iraqi people, as well as this broader global agenda that these actions were part of.
Larry Evers, it's interesting you mentioned he was a consultant for Unocal and now Chevron Texaco in Iraq, and Chevron Texaco taking over Unocal.
Well, it is interesting, because one of the arguments for the takeover was that oil is in short supply and the majors are having difficulty in finding enough oil reserves. And in my book, I go into this at great length, but essentially one of the reasons for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, it was part of a multifaceted plan to gain more control over world oil supplies, which aren't simply about fueling SUVs in the United States. Oil is a tremendous weapon of control and hegemony. He who controls oil controls both the world economy and those who depend on oil. So these wars were an effort to both prevent rivals like Russia and China from gaining control over those supplies, and also part of a long-term strategy of opening these areas up to greater U.S. investment in order to try to meet this growing gap between rising world oil demand and stagnating supply. So oil, as you were mentioning, should be very much brought back into the conversation about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Larry Everest, I was just speaking with some Afghans last night who knew Zalmay Khalilzad and talked about, you know, going way back, his also role in U.S. policy around supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, right? The Mujahideen who were fighting the Soviets, and then when the Soviet Union was out, set their sights on the United States.
Well, that's right. In the late 1980s, he was part of a working group at the State Department that did that were the point people for building relations with the Mujahideen. And, of course, we know that that U.S. and Soviet clash left a million Afghanis dead and the country devastated. And, of course, that was the period of time that the CIA did have contacts and cultivated Osama bin Laden. It's also interesting what Khalilzad has done in Afghanistan during his tenure as ambassador. I mentioned laying the groundwork for having a permanent U.S. military base there, but we should also note that opium production has soared in the country, that the country is still basically a coalition of various warlords, and that one of Khalilzad's last acts in Afghanistan was to recommend that Abdul Rashid Dostum be recommended for a position in the government. And, of course, it was Dostum's militia that murdered hundreds of suspected Taliban fighters by locking them in shipping containers shortly after the U.S. Invasion there in 2001, an act of incredible brutality. And there have also been reports that his forces have been driving ethnic Pashtuns from their villages and raising the villages and so on. So this gives a sense of the kind of brutality that Khalilzad and the other members of the Bush administration are willing to bring to bear to advance these objectives we've been discussing this morning.
And Larry Everest, the PNAC recommendations project for a new American century back under President Clinton and Zalmay Khalilzad's role in that.
Well, he signed the letter that you mentioned that called for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. This was an open letter to Bill Clinton in 1998. And while the foreign policy dispute was not the leading edge of the Clinton impeachment, it was certainly an element in this vociferous right-wing campaign to get rid of Clinton. The right wing felt that Clinton was not acting aggressively enough around the world, was not seizing the moment to assert U.S. hegemony as forcefully as it should. And one of the interesting things about the letter that Khalilzad signed with a number of other of the luminaries of the right wing was that it made no mention of the threat of terror whatsoever, and only passing reference to the danger of weapons of mass destruction. The focus of the letter was that Saddam Hussein's continued existence, his continued rule, was threatening U.S. dominance in the Middle East, and that action was needed in order to strengthen Israel, to strengthen U.S. Arab allies, and to ensure U.S. control of Persian Gulf oil supply. So these were the real motives of the 2003 invasion. Studying Khalilzad and getting into this whole global agenda that he's been such a key part of articulating and developing really, really points to the true motives for that 2003 war, a war, as I mentioned, that was a decade in the making.
Finally, Larry Everest, you talked about Paul Wolfowitz. Now he heads up the World Bank. Zalmay Khalilzad nominated to be the ambassador to Iraq. What about Wolfowitz and the significance of this new position?
Well, I feel you can look at Khalilzad's nomination, Wolfowitz's nomination, and Bolton's nomination all as a piece. They represent, I feel, the desire by the Bush government not to be restrained in its second term, but to more aggressively push forward this effort to really, and particularly with Wolfowitz and Bolton, it's an effort to really lower the status of Europe, Japan, Russia, and other potential competitors to a more second-tier subordinate status. I think the U.S. was, of course, very upset that France and Russia didn't rubber-stamp the war in Iraq. There's concerns about the world World Bank and its role for example, one thing that could be an outcome of Wolfowitz's nomination is approving a U.S.-driven privatization and funding of U.S. projects in Iraq. So again, I see these as steps, a piece in the sense of very aggressively pushing forward this agenda. And we've got to be clear that these actions are very likely to lead to further conflict and suffering in many parts of the world, as well as the potential for tremendous upheaval and resistance as these plans unfold.
Larry Everest, I want to thank you for being with us. Author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, writes for the Revolutionary Worker. Antonia Yuhas, author and activist, speaking to us from California. And De La Piro, author of Secrets and Lies, Operation Iraqi Freedom and After. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at the Majority Leader of the House, Tom DeLay, and the latest scandals that he is embroiled in. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay is in the news again. Both the New York Times and the Washington Post had front page exposés yesterday that could lead to new ethics investigations. The Washington Post reported DeLay took a 6-day trip to Moscow in 1997 that may have been secretly funded by Russian businesses with ties to the Russian government. Officially, the trip was paid for by a mysterious company registered in the Bahamas. House rules bar lawmakers from taking trips paid for by foreign agents. And the New York Times reported that Tom DeLay's wife and daughter have been paid more than $500,000 since 2001 by DeLay's Political Action Committee. Campaign finance experts say it's not uncommon for relatives to be paid, but the sums paid to DeLay's family were unusually generous. These are the latest controversies that surround DeLay, who was admonished 3 times last year by the House Ethics Committee. Meanwhile, 3 associates of the congressmember are under indictment in Texas on state charges in connection with efforts to redraw the state's congressional districts. On Wednesday, DeLay defended payments to his family and his trip to Moscow and called the reports, quote, just another seedy attempt by the liberal media to embarrass me. He said the Republican Party continues to back him. However, last week, the conservative Wall Street Journal editorial page weighed in on the DeLay controversies and chastised him for his ethical lapses. The paper stated DeLay has, quote, odor issues and that his fault lies in betraying the broader set of principles that brought him into office, and which, if he continues as before, sooner or later, will sweep him out. Joining us on the phone from Texas is Lou DeBose. He is the author of the political biography of Tom DeLay called The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of Republican Congress. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Glad to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't we start here and work our way back? Can you talk about these 2 latest revelations?
Well, you know, we've known for a while that the DeLay family was being paid by that his daughter Dani Farrow and his wife Christine were being paid by the PACs. I think the Times did a great job of putting it all together and just doing the numbers. This is the first sign really of what some critics of the lay sense must be out there, and that is that there is some personal enrichment in this. That the guy doesn't do this for ideology and love, but for money. You know, he lives in a pretty modest condo out in Arlington. He has a house on the golf course, probably worth $350,000 in Sugar Land. But, by congressional standards, he doesn't seem to be a rich man. But he is the most powerful man in Congress, and this is a payback. I think all these trips, Amy, are. There's a thread that runs through all of them, and that thread is Jack Abramoff. And every one of these trips, except the Korean trip, I take that back. Jack Abramoff has been involved, and other former DeLay staff members involved in a similar trip that he took to Korea 3 weeks ago. Broke in the Washington Post. He took a trip to Korea that was funded by indirectly funded by a foreign agent. The thread is Abramoff, though. Abramoff was involved in the Washington in the trip to Moscow. Abramoff has been involved in a trip to England that Tom DeLay took. Abramoff went on that golfing trip to England. That was a trip that ran up a $70,000 tab, kind of expensive for a couple of days golf in England. Is he dragging the pot there? Is some of the money actually going into Tom DeLay's pocket? I mean, these are things that are going to be these are questions that ought to be asked by the House Ethics Committee, but won't. Jack Abramoff is a longtime Tom DeLay associate who, together with Mike Scanlon, a guy who was paying off his college debt when he left Tom DeLay's employment 4 years ago, bilked 81, 82, it could be as much as $100 million by the time all the numbers are run, from six Indian tribes for whom they were lobbying. This is an enormous lobby scandal involving two men with very close associations to Tom DeLay, and they're the guys who have been arranging the trips, who've been getting on the phone and calling these American Indian tribes and saying, we need $25,000 for DeLay from one tribe, we need $25,000 for another tribe, so you can go play golf in Scotland. Abramoff is also did the same thing for Bob Ney with an implied Democrat, a Republican from Ohio, with an implied promise that Bob Ney would carry a specific piece of legislation, attach it to a voting bill for an Indian tribe in Texas. So this there's a pattern here, and the pattern is Jack Abramoff takes care of Tom DeLay, and Tom DeLay takes care of Jack Abramoff.
Can you talk about the response of the tribes of the various nations that have, how much money have they given, and the significance of the recent hearing that exposed Abramoff and Scanlon, if you do think that, and are they done?
Abramoff and Scanlon done? It's almost certain they're going to be indicted. There is a multi-agency task force looking into them. There are two grand juries in Washington. There's a federal prosecutor in Washington. There are tribes filing suit to recover their money. I mean, what this was, you have to go back to 95 when Tom DeLay domesticated K Street, when he told lobbyists that you're going to contribute money to the Republican Party or you're not going to have access. And he changed the culture of lobbying. You know, if it was bad then, it's cancerous now. And there's a clear understanding among big lobbyists such as Jack Abramoff and Mike Scanlon that they're gonna have these big lobby jobs, but they're gonna max out in contributions to the Republican Party. And look at Scanlon; he's 31 years old. Was 31 years old when he made a $500,000 contribution in 2002. To the National Republican Governors Group. Well, that money came directly from American Indian tribes. You know, I'm down here in Louisiana looking at invoices for $1.5 million for the Coushatta tribe for lobbying, which they really never did. They never did much for them. And I'm looking for requests for $100,000 for an environmental group founded by Gail Norton, before she was an interior, at Secretary of Interior, the $25,000 that the Cushota Indians in backwater swamp Louisiana, in Kinder, Louisiana, they're giving $25,000 to Grover Norquist. This is not just this is not just an individual scandal. It's a scandal that involves, as congressional scholar Norm Hornquist said, a Tammany Hall shakedown of lobbyists. These lobbyists get their jobs, and in turn, we're talking about jobs that pay $1 million a year, $1.5 million a year. They get these jobs, and in turn, they understand that they're to funnel money to Republican campaign operations. And that's why it's so difficult for the Republicans in the House. It's one reason to vote, to have a come to Jesus call with Tom DeLay and say it's time for you to go, because he's the guy who set this up. He set up the K Street Project along with Grover Norquist, who's now taking money from American Indian tribes. These guys have no interest in Americans for tax reform. Norquist is a star of the beast lobby. But it's a huge scandal that involves, Tom DeLay and a number of lobbyists who pay what in southern Italy and Sicily is called tributo to the Republican Party, and the Indians are, they're going to court. I mean, they're filing suit. There's too much litigation now for the true story of Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff not to be told, I think.
We're talking to Lou DeBose, author of The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Party, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. In these last few minutes, Lou, what do you think is going to happen next with Tom DeLay? He is blaming, saying this is a seedy attempt by liberal media to bring him down. What about the significance of the closed-door meeting of Republicans that was held this week, apparently inside a number of Republicans raising concerns? The Wall Street Journal talking about the stench around DeLay?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the end, how much, Tom DeLay owns the House, and he owns it because he bought it. He has contributed more money to Republican, his PAC has contributed more money to Republican candidates than any other member of Congress. So he's bought the loyalty of the House, and he got them five seats in six seats in the last, out of Texas, and a lot of new congressional seats out of Texas in the last election by redrawing the state lines after he illegally raised and spent money here in Texas. I think the question they're asking now is, at what point is this guy a stone around our neck? Do we want to go into the election in the next election with, behind Tom DeLay as the poster boy for corporate and lobby corruption? However, they have rewritten the rules of the Ethics Committee so that there cannot be an investigation of any member of Congress.
And gotten rid of the Republican Ethics Committee chair who was raising questions.
They threw Joel Hafley off the top after he admonished him last time around and put in Doc Hastings, a Tom DeLay supporter, and they put in two members of other members of the committee who have contributed money to Tom DeLay's legal defense fund.
Lou DeBose, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us, author of The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, and we continue on our Unembed the Media tour. Tomorrow at noon, we'll be at Mackey Auditorium at the University of Colorado, Boulder. That's Friday at noon. At 8 o'clock in the evening, we'll be at the Presbyterian Church in Denver, Colorado. On Saturday, Omaha, Nebraska in the afternoon, and Lincoln, Nebraska in the evening. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable team of people. Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. To get more information on the Unembedded Media Tour, go to our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.